Lecture 23, Confucius, the Analects.
In our last lecture, we explored the great anti-war novel, All Quiet on the Western Front, by Eric Maria Remarque, published in 1929. And we looked at it for the theme of duty. And a generation like that of World War I that had been taught, it is your duty to fight for your country, and it is the noblest thing that you can do to die for your country. And we saw how the Great War called all of that into question. And in the course of that lecture, I said to you what I repeat now. World War I was not a useless, unnecessary war. I quote Winston Churchill on that. What made World War I a tragedy was that the results of the victory were thrown away, and that a generation came out of it unwilling to resist aggression when it appeared again in the form of Adolf Hitler. It is therefore for that reason that Churchill called World War II the unnecessary war. Had people been willing to learn from the lesson of World War I that you must meet aggression wherever it appears, that it is cheaper to stop aggression at first sight rather than let it grow and grow and grow, then World War II was unnecessary. But people did not want to hear that in the 1920s and 30s, and that's why All Quiet on the Western Front was such an enormous success. Remarque was certainly not a voice crying in the wilderness. He was, in fact, saying what almost everyone believed and wanted to believe. The Nazis, of course, despised him, and he was forced to leave Germany, and they even spread all kinds of lies about him. They said his original name was Kramer, and that he was Jewish. And you will still find that on the Internet, even though it's long since been, you know, disproven. He went to Hollywood and married Paulette Goddard, the movie star, and lived off quite happily in Hollywood and then finally going back to Switzerland and had a very enjoyable life. After all, he was independently wealthy by the age of 33. He wrote scripts for Hollywood. So I don't know whether he was destroyed by the war or not, even though he escaped at shells. But from the question of duty in war, we want to turn now to the question of duty in government and how the individual should behave towards his own government, how government should behave towards the individual, and how ultimately there should be no separation in your duty to yourself, in the way you live your life, and what you expect from your government. For a good government acts on behalf of the well-being of its subjects, and that is its foremost concern, the well-being of its subjects. And for this, we turn away from Europe to China, to Confucius, to one of the three great teachers in history. We've already talked about two of these, Socrates and Jesus. We want now to explore the third and come back and compare all three of them. For our theme is indeed duty, how Confucius described duty, but also how he taught it to his students. And our theme thus is also education, the process by which we learn what is our duty and the role of a great teacher in that instruction. Confucius, just by the dry statement of an encyclopedia, was born in 552 B.C., in China, of course, in the little principality of Lu, and would live on until 479. He came from a family that was educated and distinguished, that had migrated to the little kingdom, or little principality of Lu, in a period in which China was divided into a number of warring states. Civilization came later to China than it did to Egypt and to Mesopotamia. Remember, we said that the birth of civilization occurred in Mesopotamia and Egypt around 3000 BC, and we define that birth of civilization as marked by writing, the use of bronze, the use of metal, in other words, building monumental structures, and complex government organizations. This would develop in China around 1700 BC. And by our time of Confucius, by the 6th century BC, the Chinese emperor had become essentially a puppet. And China was divided into several states that tentatively are, in theory, still owed loyalty to the emperor, but which were in fact governed by dukes or other aristocratic figures. And Confucius would pass his life passing from one of these small states to the other. At first, for a good part of his life, he was indeed a civil servant and held the office of chief of police, commissioner of police, in his little nation of Lu. But he was dismissed from service or went into exile. The stories differed. But according to the best account, his advice was not taken. He had given advice as police commissioner. It was not taken. And then there was held a ritual, a sacrifice, and he was not given his proper share of the meat. And thus he went into exile. But he went into exile, his student said, not because he didn't receive his share of the meat, but to show that he held it wrong to disregard the formalities and the rituals. And this high regard for formality, for the ancient rites and rituals, was fundamental to the teaching of Confucius. He would then pass a number of years going from one small principality to another, giving advice, being honored for his wisdom, looked upon as a wise man, but his advice was very seldom taken. He was not given positions of authority. And he would return in his last years to the little principality of Lu, where he would die in 479. Leaving his mark, not as an administrator, not through rules and regulations that he put into effect, but as a teacher. As a teacher. And as such, he had a tremendous influence. Confucius shaped the civilization of China for more than 2,000 years to come, right on up until the 20th century. He shaped the civilization of China. And his sayings, his teachings, the works he believed should be studied, were fundamental to the entire, not only educational system of China, but to its entire government structure. And civil servants and officials at all levels, right on up to the emperor, studied the sayings of Confucius, studied the works that he brought forth in terms of editing them and approving them. And only way to get to be a civil servant in China was to pass examinations based on the learning of Confucius. So it is a tremendous impact that he had as a teacher. He would put aside these facts about his life and instead want us to know that at the age of 15, I began to study. I set my heart upon studying, he said. And at the age of 30, I took my stand. At the age of 40, I put aside all doubts. At the age of 50, I understood the decree of heaven. At the age of 60, my ears were attuned. And at the age of 70, I trod the path of truth without overstepping the bond. I tread the path of truth and did what my heart desired in truth. That was his real intellectual pilgrimage. And for any great teacher, that is what life is about. Not a series of events that happen outside, but rather your own intellectual and spiritual development. I set about to study. And his pupils, his students, and he taught big classes. At one point, it's reported he has 3,000 students, but he also had an inner circle of disciples that he would share even more knowledge and information with. And they are the ones who pass on what we know about Confucius. See, like Socrates, like Jesus, he never wrote a book. And all his wisdom was gathered into sayings by his students. He taught us, they said, the masters they always refer to, Kung Chu in Chinese, or Confucius as the West knows him. The master taught us, one, culture. He taught us the way of moral instruction. He taught us to be steadfast. And he taught us to tell the truth. Those were the four lessons he gave us. Culture. He taught us moral instruction in the way, in the truth, He taught us again and again to be steadfast, and he taught us to tell the truth. So Confucius was a teacher of moral lessons. But he believed this morality that he taught had to be founded in the works of antiquity. I loved antiquity, he said. That is what set me to studying. For Confucius, to cut yourself off from the past, from the great works and ideas that had been before, was to leave you without any roots. Like a tree, you would topple over. Thus he studied history and played a role in bringing together and editing one of the ancient Chinese chronicles of the past. Simply a list of events that happened. But history and knowledge of the past was fundamental, he believed. And poetry. The odes. He brought forth, through his influence, a culling down, a limiting of all the poetry of China to 300 odes he thought were crucial. The odes of Confucius that were always sung. And he believed that music and the words of the poetry put to music was essential to creating a harmony in the soul. And he shared with Socrates this profound belief that your soul must be in harmony. And music is the outward expression of it. Now to us, and even to many who read the odes in China, what do these odes have to say? They seem quite unrelated, unspecific to any kind of definite moral instruction, such as, the cherry blossoms wave on the tree. You are far away, but I think about you. That would be an ode. And Confucius would sing it to his students. They would look absolutely puzzled, and he would explain, well, he says that even though you are far away, he thinks about you. Well, if he wants to be with you, he will be with you. He will not be thinking about you. Thus he is lying. And every time he would quote one of these odes, and as he would teach his students, it would be to use that ode in such a way that this seemingly meaningless message, in terms of being quite removed from what the point that was being made, in fact, spoke directly to the truth. Always tell the truth. Beware of the man or the woman who smiles at you and says you are their friend, for they are not being trustworthy. And he loved those who could quote those odes back to him in the appropriate way. And they became, for the whole of Chinese civilization, a means of speaking the truth without having to come right out and say it. And so these odes would be said over and over again to convey a political or an individual message. Cherry blossoms wave on the tree. You are far away, but I think about you. So know those odes. No man can begin on the path of wisdom until he knows those odes. He knows that poetry that speaks to the soul. So his message, again, is rooted in a concrete knowledge of the past and of the idea of what makes a great work. And he believed in carrying out the rituals, ancient rituals that had come down from even 1,000 years before, how to offer up sacrifice, the kind of clothes to wear on specific occasions, and the understanding that such rituals must change to suit new circumstances and new times. It is an idea that I suppose we can encapsulate by the word civility. But far more important is the idea of harmony. Acting in such a way, carrying out certain formalities, is the way we preserve the harmony around us. And it is a harmony based on everyone knowing their place and what is expected of them. You want to be a government leader. Well, why don't you start out by being a good son? And the relationship and the duty of a good son to the father was for Confucius the entire harmony of the world. So start off by being a good father to your son and expect your son to be a good father to you. Confucius was asked towards the end of his life, Why don't you try to go back into government? It is set down from the past, he said, that by being a good father or by being a good son, you are doing the most that you can for your government. You ever pondered that? By being a good citizen, by taking care of your family, maybe you are doing far more for your government, for your country, than you could be by neglecting them, by putting them aside. It's a useful lesson for us to remember. And so these rites, these formalities, learn them. Learn when they must be adapted. But base our lives upon a kind of harmony. That's something, again, that we have no conception of in our own age. Neither dress codes nor any kind of message of formality, even in our conversation, exist. I don't say it's bad. I just say it is fundamentally different from how Confucius saw the harmony of the universe. So out of the odes, out of a knowledge of history, out of a respect for the past, Confucius taught his students to follow the way, the Tao. Follow the way. And the way is the truth. And his life was spent in the pursuit of truth. How to put your feet upon that path that is the way of truth. The age of 30, he took his stand. At 15, he began to study. And at the age of 30, he took his stand. That is to say, he went into government service. That was going to be his great contribution. And at 40, all his doubts were put aside. He had begun to understand the way and knew he must follow it. And at the age of 50, just at the time he was dismissed from government service, he understood the decree of heaven. One of the things the master never talked about, his students said, were the gods. And it is true that the divine world plays almost no role whatsoever in the thought of Confucius. We find our way without specifically looking or invoking the gods. But the decree of heaven for him was his proper place and destiny in the world. And that was as a teacher. And thus, by the age of 60, his ears were properly attuned. He knew what he should be doing. And by the age of 70, that's late in life, isn't it? He was finally conscious that he was treading the path of truth and would not pass away from it. So he had achieved his life's goal. What is the way of truth? It is basically the way of benevolence. And for Confucius, the whole of human behavior, the whole of your duty to your country, to your family, to your fellow human beings, is not to do to someone else what you do not want them to do to you. In other words, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. The whole of human behavior is summarized in that goal, to do unto others. And that is the path of what can be translated in English as benevolence. But that is a very weak word. You know, we say somebody is benevolent when they're kind of easygoing. No, benevolence is the way of truth. Benevolence is harmony in the universe. Benevolence is what is good. And the path of the good, the path of the truth, is marked in our character by wisdom, by courage, by justice. Wisdom, courage, and justice. These are fundamental to the entire teaching of Confucius. Justice, doing unto others as you would have them do unto you. And courage. It is steadfastness in the truth. It is doing what needs to be done, unafraid of the consequences. And to know what needs to be done, why, that is wisdom. And wisdom is the ultimate goal of the teacher and the searcher after the truth. And joining those together to make sure they work in harmony is moderation. Not to be excessive. Not to be excessive in your adherence to the rites, to the ancient rituals. Not to be excessive and harsh in giving out judgment. Not to be excessive and harsh in the judgments you pass upon others. Where have you heard those virtues before? Have you not heard them in Socrates? Wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation. And with that, I want to raise a question that we will return to at the end of our lectures, at the end of this course. Is there not a universal set of values that govern all people in all times and all civilizations accept as the truth? Because remember, whenever we talk about teaching values in the school, the question is immediately raised, well, whose values? Everybody has their own set of values. Well, if we compare Socrates from the 5th century B.C. in Greece and Confucius from the 5th century B.C. in China, we see these same basic virtues, these same moral truths of wisdom, justice, courage, and moderation as the way to live your life. And both of these, Socrates and Confucius, devoted their lives to teaching others this path of virtue. They are both philosophers. And Confucius consistently labels himself as a searcher after the truth, after wisdom. And that is exactly what Socrates was. Remember when we talked about the Phaedo? He is a philosopher. And the philosopher spends his entire life searching for that Sophia, that wisdom, which he loves. And the search for that itself is the way to truth. And they join in this search, the third of our great teachers, Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and the light. And Jesus in his own day was regarded as a teacher. He is called rabbi. The Greeks and Romans called him a sophist, a professor. What do these three great teachers have in common? Because that brings us not just to the question of duty, which is so fundamental to Confucius, but to the question of education. You know, vast amounts of money are spent upon education. And no politician would dare stand up and say, I am opposed to education, would they? But like Socrates, it is a term that we must question. Remember how Socrates got everybody mad at him, and you're going to get mad at me now, by going around and saying you're all the time talking about what makes a good state, Pericles, a good country, a good government. Well, how do you define a good government? You, Euthyphro, you're always talking about piety. Well, how do you define piety? Well, we might say to politicians today, how do you define education? Well, take it back to its Latin root. It means to lead out from, educo, to lead out from you. And Jesus, Socrates, and Confucius wanted to bring out from their students, their disciples, the truth that was already there. What Socrates called a divine spark. A divine spark that was already there, that had been covered up by all the false information of the world. So their concept of education was the same, to bring out from you what was already there in its purity, but misinformation and the ways of the world had led you to forget. So in other words, to take you from wandering and put you on a true path, to set your feet on the path, as Confucius said. Secondly, all three of these great teachers never wrote a book. Now, why is that? Why did Socrates never write a book? Why did Jesus not write a book? Why did Confucius never write a book? And I told you, and you didn't think I was serious, but it is simply a fact, that these three greatest teachers in history, Socrates, Jesus, and Confucius, would never get tenure at a university. Now, I think that is a terrifying indictment of the university system, as would they. They never wrote a book because they are true searchers after the truth. To write down all of this is to say, I've got it once and for all. But they knew that the search for truth is a lifelong pursuit. What also unites them is their message. For all three of them said, the true teacher doesn't teach you about calculus or chemistry or history of any of that. The true teacher is the moral guide for you. And the true purpose of education is to make you better. Better as an individual and better as a citizen of your country. That was what Confucius was after. Good individuals who in their lives practiced the truth, the benevolence, treated others as they wanted to be treated, and thus they would, by that very fact, become good citizens. And all three, Socrates, Jesus, and Confucius, believe that ultimately you cannot separate your private morality and private life from your duty as a citizen. The good moral individual will be a good moral citizen. You know what they also had in common and that our age cannot understand is a notion of redemption. That is to say, you can make a lot of mistakes as you go through life, but if you stay on the path, then in the end you will be justified. And every one of them is willing to say, I contradicted myself. And to give every individual the chance to change and to learn. Otherwise, what is education about? If you already know everything, and if you're already living exactly the way you should, and not going to make any mistakes, then you don't need a teacher. And what good is that teacher unless the teacher himself is willing to change and to grow intellectually? And that is why for Confucius, the real key to his life were those stages of learning. At 15, I began to learn, and at 30, I took my stand. At 40, I was free from doubts. At 50, I finally understood the decree of heaven. Not until I was 50. At 60, my ears were attuned, and at 70, I finally walked the path of truth. But all three of these great teachers not just stood inside a classroom. They went out into the world. Remember, Jesus talks about at Capernaum to Peter, this is why I have come out, to preach this message, to teach. And Socrates could have lived to a ripe old age, well, he did live to a ripe old age, but to have died honored and in bed if he had been willing just to talk to students. But he went out into the world and questioned writers of tragedy. He questioned politicians. He questioned leading citizens who thought they knew everything. And he aroused much anger and hatred. And Confucius, even though his advice was almost never taken, went around and around and around trying to get those in the leading levels of government to pay attention to this way of benevolence and truth. So they took upon themselves this task. They went out into the world. They also understood their own limits. Socrates is always saying, and not just in jest, I greatly admire these professors who charge large salaries for their lectures because they're able to teach people things. I am just a searcher after the truth. I can't teach you anything. All I can do is help you come forth with an idea. And Confucius says, I will point out to somebody one corner of the square, but that person has got to go and find the other three. I have never met a wise man, Confucius said. I would be content, he said, just to meet somebody who lived a life of benevolence. And each one was willing to give their life for their truth. Confucius was allowed to live out his life, but on one occasion he was threatened with assassination, and he said, that man can kill me, but he cannot take away the truth that is in me. He cannot take away my virtue. And Socrates would go to his death, and among his last words would be, Anitus and Melitus, those who have persecuted me, can take away my life, but they cannot harm me. They cannot make me do something that is immoral and wrong. Only you can harm yourself. And Jesus, why, he died on the cross. He took upon himself that great suffering. So all three are true teachers because they did not limit themselves just to putting forth a message. Their lives were their message, and their lives spoke to the truth that they want to lead you to. So Confucius, Socrates, and Jesus, these great teachers who embody the concept of duty to the truth and the duty of the teacher to live that truth.